Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. As civil war continues in Syria and a caliphate bursts into existence in Iraq, suddenly all eyes are on Israel. Israeli citizens have been murdered, bombs rain down on Gaza. We ask, how has this tragic situation come about, and what can both sides do to bring it to a conclusion? I'm joined in the studio by The Telegraph's chief foreign correspondent David Blair, by Professor Alan Johnson, a senior research fellow at the Britain-Israeli Communications and Research Centre, and by Chris Doyle, the director of the Council for Arab-British Understanding. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of visiting Israel, and I would describe it as the most moving journey of my entire life. As a Christian, it was a joy to walk where we believe that Jesus walked. But it was also fascinating, as an outsider, to stand in the middle of the disputed city of Jerusalem and to watch three very different communities try to get along. While I was there, there was peace between the Jewish and Arab populations. Today, sadly, there is not. Two separate events appear to have converged to create this current crisis. First, the abduction and murder of three Israeli teenagers, which has united Israel in grief and sparked the revenge murder of a 16-year-old Muslim boy. Second, rocket fire out of the Gaza territory has prompted a massive military response by Israel. The death toll is hard to judge, but it is rising fast. The situation appears to be escalating, but to what end? And how do we best avoid it? David Blair, if I can start by asking you to give us your opinion on how this crisis has begun.
Well, it's day three of the crisis, and the escalation has been very swift. The last figures that I saw were that 780 airstrikes have taken place, 75 Palestinians have been killed, and there have been very nearly 400 rockets fired out of the Gaza Strip at Israeli targets. Now, that's, I stress again, is just day three.
Right.
And I think some observers might have been surprised by the pace of the escalation. And there were two key moves that were made, one by each side. The first was that Hamas started firing long-range rockets, not simply at the towns that are within a 25-mile radius of the Gaza Strip, but actually at Tel Aviv, at Jerusalem, and even beyond there. And the second was that Israeli airstrikes, instead of targeting those low-level operatives who were actually engaged in firing rockets, began going after senior commanders. And there were two senior commanders killed yesterday, one from the military wing of Hamas and the other from Palestinian Islamic Jihad. So those two key moments have now passed. And that raises all sorts of questions. It's perfectly possible that the Israeli operation may escalate to become a ground operation with the use of troops. And it's also perfectly possible that that Hamas will wheel out even heavier and more long-range rockets from its stockpile.
Where do you think those troops will be put? Are we talking about an occupation of Gaza?
If it happens, and it's still very much an if, the objective would almost certainly not be to reoccupy Gaza.
Right.
And it probably wouldn't even be to topple or destroy Hamas. If there were to be ground strikes, past experience suggests that they will be limited incursions designed to hit command centers and take out stockpiles and occupy areas that have been used to fire rockets in the past, and also to entrench Israeli control over certain areas of Gazan territory in order to win bargaining counters for the sort of ceasefire negotiation that would probably follow.
Okay, and why did these rockets start firing? Why did Hamas start this barrage?
Hamas is in an exceptionally difficult position. In the space of the last couple of years, they've lost a lot of their allies. We won't go into the details, but thanks to the Syrian civil war, the axis of resistance, which once joined Hamas with Hezbollah, Syria's regime, and Iran's regime, is now broken. As a consequence, Hamas has lost a lot of sources of funding and weapons, principally from Iran. In addition to that, the downfall of Mohamed Morsi in Egypt has served to isolate Hamas even further. So they were facing a situation where they couldn't pay the 40,000 government workers who they employ within Gaza. The tunnels that once formed the bedrock of the Gazan economy were being blocked up by the Egyptian regime. They were being strangled and choked from all sides. And their one card left to play is this stockpile of rockets. And their objective appears to be to fire it off in order to conclude ceasefire negotiations on better terms than they currently have.
To conclude ceasefire negotiations, it's a little difficult to understand why one would carry out a military operation in order to bring peace.
Well, it always happens that these operations involve or trigger indirect negotiations between Israel and Hamas, mediated by Egypt.
Right.
And as a result of that, there's always a ceasefire agreement at the end. And the last ceasefire agreement in 2012, for example, provided for the Rafah border crossing with Egypt to be open. So it provided for a degree of an economic outlet for Gaza. At the moment, that border crossing is closed, and Hamas wants it open again. So they've already set out what they want to get out of this. What's interesting is that actually most of their demands are directed at Egypt, not Israel.
Right.
From Israel, they want the release of certain prisoners who were released in return for an Israeli hostage a little while back and then rearrested by Israel. They want those people out. But the rest of their demands are actually focused mainly on Egypt, and they want to open up Rafah.
And final question to you, is there a link between any of this and the murders of the Israeli teenagers? I think a lot of people listening will presume, understandably, that that's the context of this entire conflict. Is that not true? Is this something that would have happened anyway without that crime?
I think it's impossible to say.
Right.
Israel has blamed Hamas for the murder, for the abduction and the murder of the three teenagers. I don't know whether that's true or not. I don't know whether that's part of Hamas's thinking or not.
Okay. Alan Johnson, if I can start with you, what do you think needs to happen in order to resolve this crisis?
Well, I think there's some reasons to be relatively optimistic about our chances of avoiding a full-scale conflict here.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some reasons to be worried. The reasons I think to be relatively optimistic are firstly that Israel did not seek this conflict. It didn't want it. It offered and is still offering quiet in return for quiet. Secondly, Israel has no strategic interest at all in reoccupying the Gaza Strip. It has no territorial ambitions there whatsoever. That's been clear since 2005. Thirdly, and not everyone appreciates this, there's some concern in Israel about the weakness of Hamas. Israel wants an address to talk to in the Gaza Strip, and the fear is that a ground operation which fatally weakened Hamas would produce something worse, could even produce jihadis, chaos, or what some people call the Somaliization of the Gaza Strip. That's a concern amongst policymakers in Israel also. And lastly, Israel does not want to distract world attention from the P5+1 talks, which it sees the Iranian nuclear threat as existential. Reasons to be less optimistic are, I think David has referred to them, the usual interlocutors, the people who got involved in 2012 and sorted this out, are kind of missing this time. So last time there was Morsi, who was a Muslim Brotherhood figure. Hamas is a Muslim Brotherhood sister organization, and he was able to intervene alongside America. At this point, General Sisi does not seem to be interested. The loathing for Hamas amongst the Egyptian military, you really do have to appreciate. As far as they're concerned, these are the people who came over into the Sinai, killed Egyptian police officers, plotted against them, and so on. There are some moves. Sisi has opened partially the Rafah crossing, as I understand it today, to allow injured Gazans to leave and receive medical treatment in Egypt. That could develop further. And the second interlocutor is America, of course. Now, last time in 2012, America did sit out the early days as well, so there's nothing unusual there. At a certain point, though, especially when it feared escalation, America got itself involved, and I think we have to hope that that will happen. The third reason to be less optimistic is, again, David's referred to it, a lot of what Hamas wants, Israel can't really provide.
Right.
So it wants the Rafah crossing open, and that's about Egypt. It wants 40,000 public servants paid, and that is about the PA in part. Part of the reconciliation deal was Abbas taking on that payroll. And then afterwards, Abbas said, I'm going to look at each one individually. So there's been holdups and there's real economic suffering there. So all of that is true, too. If there's word that Qatar might be interested in playing a role financially and getting involved in helping out in that regard, I think we have to look to that. In terms of what's necessary, I think Israel's options are very limited in terms of what it can affect. But real change is necessary in the Gaza Strip. A real change is necessary to the political leadership there, one that respects the quartet conditions, acknowledges the existence of Israel, and enters into a wholly different kind of relationship with it.
But you seem to suggest that leadership ultimately has to be Hamas. If the alternative is something worse, is a vacuum that jihadis fill, then the Israelis on the one hand want to punish Hamas, want to put it in its place. On the other hand, they don't want to destroy it.
Hamas always presents Israel with a set of excruciating dilemmas. This is the latest. The long-standing dilemma has been, how do you prevent weaponry and munitions entering into the Strip without damaging the lives of the civilians in Gaza. That's been an excruciating dilemma since 2005, and this is the latest. How do we stop this force which is firing rockets upon us without undermining it so far that we get something worse in return? So
okay.
It's a real dilemma.
Okay, Chris Doyle, feel free to respond to any of those points, but if I can also put the same question to you, what needs to be done to resolve this?
Well, first of all, I would stress actually that what happened in the West Bank since early June, and indeed before, definitely has a bearing on what has happened in Gaza. You have to remember that after the kidnappings of the three Israeli teenagers, the arrests of around about 700, 800 Hamas and other Palestinians created a climate in which Hamas felt it needed to respond. This was necessary in its own eyes to demonstrate that it wasn't going to roll over and accept all of this. And as David said, it included the arrests of many of those that were released in the deal that saw the release of Gilad Shalit. Now, in doing that, of course, everything has escalated. We've seen escalation on both sides. And in my view, those who actually kidnapped and subsequently killed these Israeli teenagers had a political aim, and that is to kill off the Fatah-Hamas deal.
Right.
And, of course, there are spoilers on both sides who want to see that end. Now, I think that's desperately unfortunate because if there is a chance of changing the political situation in the Gaza Strip, it was through that deal, which opened the door potentially for elections down the line, talk about 6 months, which could have legitimized a new Palestinian leadership on a completely different basis. But both the Israeli government and also elements within Hamas and other groups, maybe even some within Fatah, remembering that Fatah has no real love for Hamas either, have been against this. What is certainly absent, and which is, I think, very worrying, as both David and Alan have said, the international community seems very silent. It actually seems to be absent, really, in a meaningful sense, in most of the current conflicts that are raging across the region, and it is now. And what we need to see is a ceasefire, but then not to forget what is happening in Gaza, because the reality is Gaza is a crisis that is happening the whole time. Whilst under blockade, and you have 2 million people who are struggling for survival, the water is not fit for consumption, they have no normal economic life, they can't export, imports are restricted. This is a perfect breeding ground for groups that are even more extreme than Hamas. Mm-hmm. So this is a perfect incubator for exactly the sort of ideologies that nobody wishes to see move forward and grow in strength. And there's even been the raising of ISIS flags within the Gaza Strip. So what has happened in the past is once there's been a ceasefire, as happened in 2012, as happened in 2009, everyone sort of sighed with relief and said, thank God for that, but left the situation as it is now.
Right.
Now, that can't really continue. The life of Palestinians in Gaza has been one of 66 years of statelessness, 47 years of occupation, and 8 years of blockade. And they really have very little to live for in all of this. And we have to present a very, very different horizon. And of course, you know, Hamas take a lot of the blame as well in all of this. And what have they offered? But they can use the blockade as an excuse for their own political failings.
I'll let Alan reply to all of that. I just want to ask, given that Israel has withdrawn from the Gaza Strip, is this not a problem among Arabs that needs to be sorted out by Arabs?
Well, Israel withdrew the settlers and military forces from within the Gaza Strip.
Right.
But still, there is a blockade. Now, the reality of that is that they can't have an airport and a port. They can't trade and travel freely. There are access-restricted zones, which means a lot of the agricultural land, their best agricultural land, is off limits. So it has never actually reached the sort of stage of being able to live in free conditions. And the subsequent levels of violence, we've seen attacks in 2006, 8, 12. None of them have actually achieved either security or peace for either Israelis or Palestinians. So we're having another exercise, really, in futile aggression. I cannot see it deliver what either Israelis or Palestinians would like to see.
Alan Johnson.
Well, let's remember why the blockade is in place. In 2005, when Israel withdrew, What have the leaders of the two sides said? Ariel Sharon, the Israeli prime minister at the time, had his Rubicon moment. He had decided that Israel needed to divide the land. He was pulling out initially of Gaza, and he had plans to pull out from certainly large areas of the West Bank. The speech he made as he pulled out talked about an independent Palestinian state living in peace alongside Israel. Mohammed Daif, who was the bomb maker in chief in Hamas, made a speech which said, "We will now turn all of Palestine into hell for you." And what he did thereafter and the weeks after was quadruple the rockets flying over into Israel. By 2007, when Hamas took over the Strip, murdering Fatah militants, throwing them off rooftops, they then declared that the destruction of Israel was their goal, and Israel was then obliged to impose a legal maritime blockade. The necessity of that blockade was revealed earlier this year when an Iranian ship supplying large amounts of very dangerous munitions, including rockets, which we've seen deployed in this latest engagement, was intercepted. Mm-hmm. So Israel's dilemma remains, which is that there's a radical Islamist, anti-Semitic, extremist organization which runs the Gaza Strip, which sees the destruction of Israel as its sacred goal, and Israel has to defend itself against that threat. And part of that is to make sure that those kinds of munitions don't get into the Gaza Strip. Now, I think the Palestinian National Movement is actually at a crossroads moment. I think we're really being faced with a clear choice. Either it goes down the road that Mahmoud Abbas wants to take it, which is the road of nonviolence, negotiations, back to the negotiating table. I'm not saying Israel's blameless at all in the failure of the recent talks. I think everyone involved in those talks made serious mistakes. But that's one route, which is to mutual recognition, two states for two peoples. The other route, the so-called resistance route of Hamas, is a dead end, which is producing the misery that we're seeing at the moment. Now, this is where the international community has its role, and this is where I think President Obama's notion of leading from behind is showing some of its weaknesses. I think American leadership remains necessary. It remains the indispensable nation in the Middle East, and I don't think it can shirk its responsibility to bang heads together, bang tables, ring people up, and force some kind of a new settlement in this area.
Okay, Chris, I presume you'd actually agree with a great deal of that. But I'm just wondering, we've spoken a lot about what Palestinian people need to do. In your opinion, what do Israelis need to do?
Well, I do share a lot of that opinion. I think that the absence of the Americans right now is absolutely very telling in terms of all of this. And I also share the view about, you know, Hamas and its rocketing. It doesn't achieve anything. It's a war crime. Now, in terms of what Israel needs to do, it really needs to consider, I think, the political strategy to go with its security strategy, because at the moment it would appear to be essentially a military security strategy going forward. But what we failed to see in 2009 and 2012 was a political one. And if it is trying to ensure that Mahmoud Abbas and those who want negotiations are dominating the Palestinian political scene, then I think they really have to consider their moves over the last particularly 12 months in really increasing the building of settlements and all of this, which has undermined them systematically in Palestinian eyes. There is no belief or confidence in these negotiations whatsoever. And this is actually also what happened in disengagement when the Israelis left Gaza. He was newly elected only 6-7 months before, and yet the Israeli government refused to negotiate leaving Gaza. This meant that it was Hamas who said, "It's us who got the Israelis out," and they sent some rockets off afterwards as a demonstration and so forth. And that actually augmented and increased Hamas's popularity amongst Palestinians. So if Israel wants a political strategy, it should be to try to strengthen those elements within the Palestinian political system that really do want to do a deal and live together in peace and find a viable second state. It's not the way that things are going at the moment. And I think it's very difficult, I think, in this current Israeli coalition. The divisions are obviously acute. You see different things being said by different ministers. Some want to be infinitely more hardline and have a ground invasion of Gaza. Others, like Zippy Livni, have a very differing perspective. But they really have to consider that if they want peace on that southern border, that the 2 million inhabitants of the Gaza Strip need to have an horizon that is just not endless occupation, blockade, and conflict.
Okay. David Blair, if I could bring you back in, just to sum up, I was really struck by some of the remarks that Alan made about how there are fewer international people to talk to, but also within the region, with Morsi being gone. As the region becomes more and more unstable, how does that play into the politics of this situation? I mean, Israel's surrounded by Syria, it's got Iraq close by, it's got Egypt in flux. Has this made this whole crisis all the more difficult to resolve?
Yes, the normal interlocutors are absent or silent for various reasons. And the great danger is that this leads to an emphasis purely on short-term solutions. There's a phrase which I find rather chilling, which is repeated quite a lot. It's mowing the lawn. Mm. It's a military phrase for operations that, in their very nature, have to be repeated at regular intervals. And we've seen this vis-a-vis Israel and Gaza repeatedly over the years. So 2008 to 2009, we had Operation Cast Lead. Then we had Operation Pillar of Defense in 2012. Now we have Operation Protective Edge in 2014. On the trajectory that we're on at the moment, there'll be Operation something else, Protective something else in 2016, 2018, 2020, 2022. And by the way, the population of Gaza is doubling every 20 years or so. It's now pushing 2 million. In 20 years' time, it will be closer to 4 million. I mean, this is an absolutely terrible forecast. You can't blame one side alone for this. The truth is that the both sides have shown a degree of political failure and moral bankruptcy that has led us to this path. And at the moment, it's very hard to identify a single point of light of how it might possibly there be as an escape route.
Alan Johnson, to conclude, what do you think, if I can ask you to predict, I know it's very difficult, especially given the nuance of the situation, what do you think in a week's time the situation will be?
It's very difficult to say. Israel's position is that the rockets must stop, and if Hamas can't stop them, Israel will have to.
Right.
There's a lot of pressure within Israel, not just from within the right of the political spectrum, but across the spectrum and amongst the communities now, not just of the south, who've been under this kind of rocket fire for 7 years and needing to be under close proximity to bomb shelters, but areas much further north now, 100 miles the furthest rocket has reached. So it's not really conceivable that Israel will be able to withstand all of that pressure indefinitely and simply tolerate this kind of rocketry. My suspicion is that I agree with David's analysis of why Hamas got itself involved in this. My hope, rather, is that Hamas will pull back.
Yeah.
It will calculate that the kind... I think Israel dropped more targeted, more strikes in the first 36 hours of this operation than the entirety of Operation Pillar of Defense in 2012. So there's an enormous damage being done to Hamas's infrastructure, and hopefully that will persuade it to pull back. If not, then we will see a further massing of troops on the border and possibly, reluctantly, an intervention on the ground.
And finally to you, Chris Doyle, we've spoken a lot about Hamas and the militant leadership among ordinary Palestinian people. What is their desire?
Well, firstly, they just want to see an end of these operations. And
right.
I think that typically what's happening in these operations is eventually the civilian casualties raised to such levels, and we've already seen maybe 80 people killed, many of them children and women and so forth, that the international community puts the pressure on to sort of call a halt to all of this. But the Palestinians do want to see not only just an end of the current escalation in Gaza, but they want to see peace and freedoms within the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And, you know, if you are in Gaza, you can't go to the West Bank. The divisions in Palestinian society have been acute. They want to see an end to the settlement building and ultimately be able to live normal lives, which they have not been able to do for decades. So we're a long, long way from that. And as I said, I'd emphasize, you need to strengthen those parties who are prepared to negotiate, who actually have a vision for the future of Palestine and not play into the hands of the extremists.
David Blair, your final thoughts on the basis of everything you've heard.
Just one point that may be worth emphasizing. After previous operations, Hamas has been able to replenish and resupply its stockpiles of rockets, principally because the supply lines to Iran were still largely intact. Today, it's a lot more complicated. It's a lot more difficult for them. It's not by any means clear that they'll be able to replace the rockets that they're currently firing off. So that may be one faint glimmer of optimism, that the pressure on them to agree a ceasefire may be greater earlier now than it was in previous crises.
David Blair, Alan Johnson, and Chris Doyle, thank you all very much.